Welcome to The Positive Mind. This is Dr. Sherry Siegel sitting in for Armand DeMille while he's away. We're here today with research assistant Lauren Sykes. Hi, Lauren.
Hello, Dr. Siegel.
And in a minute, I'll introduce a special guest who's here in the studio to help us understand how the brain and the mind can stop moving, why it happens, and ways to recover. But first, I want to share with you two amazing descriptions of paralysis. One is paralysis of the brain and the other paralysis of the mind. The first one is from Jean-Dominique Bobie's memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And he says, "No need to wonder where I am or to recall that life I once knew was snuffed out Friday, the 8th of December last year. Up until then, I had never heard of the brainstem. I've since learned that it's an essential component to our internal computer, an inseparable link between the brain and the spinal cord. That day, I was brutally introduced to this vital piece of anatomy when cerebrovascular accident took my brainstem out of action. In the past, it was known as a massive stroke, and you simply died. But improved resuscitation techniques have now prolonged and refined the agony. Paralyzed from head to toe, the patient, his mind intact, is imprisoned inside his own body, unable to speak or move. In my case, blinking my left eyelid was my only means of communication." Bobie wrote this, is part of his memoir, just by blinking his eye to convey letters of the alphabet to a woman who helped transcribe the story. It's an amazing story, and I'm sure that some of you out there have either read the book or you've possibly seen the movie. The next passage I'd like to read is from Susan Krupa's description of severe writer's block. She says, "Sometimes writer's block is simply not knowing where to go next, but sometimes it's deeper. I think connected to fear and lack of confidence, the feeling that any combination of words that you put on the page will be stupid or flat. This is the harder one to shake. The writer can get a distorted image of her writing, like an anorexic's distorted body image, and can't gain enough confidence to keep writing." Those, to me, are powerful descriptions of the crippling effects of paralysis, whether it's of the brain or of the mind. Movement is really essential to living our lives. Even the simplest thing, speaking, eating, walking out to the car, and thinking about our emotions. If we are not able to move on with our emotions, we can't flush them out. We can't move on. So what if you needed to move, but your body would not cooperate? Or what if you needed to write an assignment or fill out an application for a job, but you could not get your body to do that work or your mind to cooperate? Paralysis, I know you're all familiar with it, but the definition is it's the loss of the ability to move or a state of powerlessness or an incapacity to act. As a neurologist, I can remember first seeing paralysis when I took care of a patient at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx. It was a prim, brown-haired lady, very well-groomed, and she was ready to leave the hospital, despite the fact that she could not move her left arm or her left leg at all, not an inch off the bed. She was ready to go home. So today I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Grove to discuss with us the mysteries of paralysis of the mind and of the brain. Dr. Michael Grove is a psychotherapist, licensed clinical social worker who studied psychology at Temple University, and that's where Lauren studied as well. He received his PhD from Bryn Mawr College. And for his doctoral dissertation, he traveled to Jamaica to study the ways that to improve family members' attitudes toward therapy. He completed his training at the Gestalt Center for Psychotherapy in 1980. Since that time, Dr. Grove has taught undergraduate and graduate level college courses at 5 different colleges, including Marymount, Manhattan College, Fairleigh Dickinson University, John Jay, University of Alabama, and he supervised scores of therapists in training. Currently, Dr. Grove is the president of the Organization, Consulting, and Work Psychology Division of the New York State Psychological Association and helps clients in all aspects of personal and family growth from his practice in Midtown, New York City. Dr. Grove, welcome to The Positive Mind.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So we talked a little bit about paralysis of the mind and of the brain before the show, and I wanted to know, as a psychologist who's probably seen many people with psychological paralysis, what does it look like to you?
Well, it's a shock. The individual often has a lot of fear, a lot of frustration, and unable to do the things they used to do. They feel a loss of identity. Am I still who I was? Can I still be who I used to be? They can feel very confused about that, and rightfully so. Also, they have lost their major way of expressing themselves. Some people can't talk without moving their hands. You'd be surprised how much you can't think if you can't move your body. It's a whole new way of being. You know, we are not a mind, we're not a body, we're both, we're interconnected. And when you have a severe disruption between that connection, it throws everything out of kilter.
Absolutely. I've certainly seen patients who've had strokes, and even though their language centers are intact, they have a very hard time expressing themselves. And Lauren did some research on writer's block, which is a really common form of psychological paralysis. Lauren, what did you have to share with us?
Well, going off what Dr. Grove had said about the interconnectedness, researchers have come up with a term called executive dysfunction, which is used to describe this, you know, this inability. So it's described as an inability to inhibit present behavior in deference to the demands of the future. So, for example, putting off doing the application or writing that essay in exchange for maybe logging onto Facebook and checking messages or watering the plants. So it's basically putting off what you need to be done in the future in order to have temporary comfort.
So that you'd call maybe an executive function or executive dysfunction.
Exactly.
And the executive functions in the brain are housed in the frontal lobes. So those are very important areas of the brain. They really tell you how to plan your activities, how to prioritize. They tell you what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And when they're broken or not functioning normally in the person who has, for example, ADD, or someone with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, or attention deficit disorder, that can be a terrible problem. Have you seen patients or clients who suffer with that, Dr. Grove?
All the time for many years. And one of the main things that they have is they come in with a lot of frustration. And sometimes it takes a long while for them to recognize that they have the problem. It's usually been, well, I'm too lazy. Well, I'm just not interested. Well, I'm just not a good student. I'm just a bad person. I just don't like to go along with things. They have rationalizations to explain their inabilities.
And so do you think they're really lazy at heart? What do you think of that?
Not at all. Sometimes they work extremely hard to accomplish just a little. And they're actually some of the hardest working people.
I think that's a great point. You know, you talk a little bit about, or you gave me an idea, the 10 categories of psychological paralysis, which I thought were fascinating to me. For example, you talked about putting the cart before the horse. What does that mean?
Well, that's a situation where people will put off doing something until they're in the mood. They say, well, I'll clean my room when I feel like it. Well, guess what? You're never going to feel like it. You don't feel like it now. Later is not going to be different. And what you need to realize is that's not how life works. I mean, it's true we eat when we feel that we're hungry. So we can't carry that into everything else. We clean the room not because we have the urge to clean the room. We clean the room because we want the result. So you have to get past the inertia that is in the way, and you start to clean it, and then when you start to clean it, then if you like the results, boy, my desk looks nice. I remember when I bought it, it looked like this. I forgot what the pattern on the wood was like. And then it's rewarding, and then you want to keep doing it.
Yes.
But you have to get the reward, and you can't get the reward until you do the action. So the action needs to come first. A little thing I say to people, just a mantra to have, is say, do, don't stew. If you're not sure, well, I got to clean my room, I'm in a bad mood. Just start doing it. And if you start doing it, maybe your mood will change. maybe your attitude towards cleaning your room will change. It's quite possible.
So it seems that people focus on the negative side of the doing rather than the results or the positive sides of what the results could bring them when they are paralyzed by that putting the cart before the horse.
Yes, sometimes they may never have seen the results before.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. So you're saying, do not sue. That's
right.
A great expression. I love that. And how about frustration freeze? You describe frustration freeze as another one of the categories of psychological paralysis.
Well, that's very common, particularly now people are looking for jobs, for example. Someone who wants to get a job in their particular professional category, and there are hundreds of places to send their resume. And that's what people will tell them. Send your resume everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere is hundreds of places. It's a lot of time and energy. It's a full-time job just sending out the resumes, then follow up with a phone call, keep track of it, keep track of the responses you get. It's a lot of work. And the thing is, you're not sure you're going to get any results. And what you have to do is realize that you have to break the task down into very small parts. Well, because I feel very frustrated and down about this, I'll just send out one resume the first day, and then two resumes the second day, then three resumes the third day, then four resumes the fourth day. And at that point, maybe you'll pick up the pace and do even more. I like the old expression, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
Mm.
And I can tell you whenever I'm going around the reservoir in Central Park, which is like 1.57 miles, and, you know, you're going to go around. Should I go around the second time? Well, I don't know. Well, let me just go up to that tree. Well, let me just go up to this spot. Let me just go up to the next spot. And sooner or later, you can get around the second time. But you don't have to know that. You just have to know you stay in the moment and you just do some forward motion until you can't do anymore.
Right. A friend of mine used to call it baby steps. And then I know in the 12-step programs, they talk about a day at a time. So you're not making a commitment forever or for a month even. You're just making it for a day.
In this case, it might even be a moment at a time.
And a moment at a time.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when you want to break that spell, which is so strong sometimes, that freeze, which is really a paralysis of the mind.
Now, there's one other thing, too, that I often have to say to people, and this is particularly true of younger people who have had nice experiences, and that it's okay to do things that require effort and are frustrating. Some people in some situations think, I don't have to work hard. It shouldn't take any effort. If it takes effort, something's not right. Well, sometimes something is right, and taking effort means you're really doing something new or harder or growing or challenging yourself.
Mm-hmm. And what can you say to a parent? Like, what would you suggest to a parent when a child is kind of stuck like that and really has that kind of fear of pushing themselves or no desire?
Well, one thing you can do is just encourage them to do the next little step. And tell them that you're rewarding their effort, not their result.
I think that's so important.
You know, when you go to the gym and you do a particular machine, well, if you do it for 4 minutes, that's better than the last time when you did it for 3.5. You don't have to look at the other little things that say, what was your heart rate or was the output in some kind of watts or however they measure it. You just did it a little longer, and you did it the way you could do it.
Right.
So the effort is the reward.
Exactly. So progress, again, progress, not perfection. And you talked before about perfectionism. Perfectionism is something I think many people suffer from, and you'd think that someone who was a perfectionist would really have no difficulty doing things, but somehow that seems to hold people back.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a very good point. One of the problems with perfectionists is they don't accept their own limitations. They don't realize to be human is to be imperfect, that there really is no such thing as perfection, something we strive for, sort of like infinity. You can't reach it.
How does that get into somebody's brain that they have to do something perfectly? How does that start out? Where is the seed planted that way?
I suppose part of it is you want to stand out. You want to be the best. You want to get the rewards. You want to compete and beat everyone else. You want to do so well that no one will ever be able to match what you did. Mm. You're not just being the best student in the class. You're the best student in the history of the school that they will ever have. And the problem there is that there's no way of knowing that. And it's very subjective. And it becomes crippling when you say, oh, my God, I can't do anything unless I do it perfectly. Well, that means you can't do anything.
Mm. It's really reminds me of the road to recovery after a stroke, for example, because the majority of strokes do get better. They don't necessarily come all the way back to previous function, but people after strokes do really begin to improve. But the idea that by tomorrow they're going to be back to normal and doing everything as expected sometimes can cripple them, rather than taking a small step, saying my first goal is going to be to lift my foot, right, or to wiggle my toes, and then to lift my leg off the bed. Little by little, people take steps to regain their ability to move.
You know, speaking of that, I have had many clients who say, won't exercise. I hate exercise. I can't exercise.
That's me.
And I said, well, can you just lift your hand? Can you just lower it? Now, if you did that 100 times, that would do a little something. If you held something in your hand, a soup can or whatever, that weighed a pound, that would do more. That's a way to start. That counts. If you could lift up and down a soup can that weighs a pound 100 times, and then you work up to 200, then you work up to 300, psychologically you'll start to feel, yes, I can do this. Mm. I can do more. I mean, you're doing it on a lower level, but it still counts. We move all the time. The difference is, do we feel rewards when we do it, or do we feel frustration? People who say, I can't exercise, are comparing themselves with runners or with people that are in the gym and they're lifting the heavy weights or they're doing the tough exercise class. But it doesn't have to be that way. Anything you do counts. It all adds up. You know, if you look at things like the Grand Canyon, or you look at caves, presumably they're made by the actions of water taking away grains of sand at a time. Grains, and it just continually builds up and builds up. And, you know, another way to think of this is a saying that I've heard, and when I thought about it, I realized it's actually more profound than it sounds. If anything is worth doing, it's worth doing less than perfectly.
Now, that's a twist. That's something different than we usually hear. So that's a very interesting way to take a look at it. And so I think another of the categories you mentioned was fear of failure. I think they kind of go hand in hand, perfectionism, feeling that that you're going to fail at being perfect. But fear of failure, that's a very common type of thinking that will paralyze someone.
Well, even more important is people say, I failed now, therefore I'll always fail. I failed now, that means I can't do it. I haven't played baseball in a while. I get out and I throw the ball. Whoa, I can't get near the strike zone. That means I can't do it anymore.
Mm.
No, what it means is that you get better by learning your mistakes. You get better by seeing, well, where did the ball miss? Well, what if I change this? What if I change that? Trial and error. It's by taking risks and trying new things that you learn. We rarely learn anything without making attempts. Mm. And we rarely improve and really grow without doing things that challenge us.
So
and
failure.
If it challenges mm-hmm. you, you have to fail sometime. So if you show me someone who's never failed at anything, I'm a little suspicious about how good they'll really be in a tough situation. You have to show that you can deal with failure and deal with setbacks and keep going. That's how you really learn. That's how you get strong and good.
So failure seems an inherent part of succeeding.
It's the background. It's the essential experience. You know, someone that is... done anything well has probably done it hundreds of times, and some of them were off the mark.
Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people who are listening to this will find that their paralysis comes from self-criticism. And I just want to take a moment here to identify who we are. We're listening to The Positive Mind on 99.5 WBAI. This is Dr. Sherry Siegel sitting in for Armand DeMille, who is usually here during this in this time slot. And we're here with Lauren Sykes and Dr. Michael Grove talking about the mysteries of the paralyzed mind and brain. So we talked about perfectionism, and what about the people who are just so critical, who can't stop criticizing themselves?
Well, let me tell you the first thing, and this goes back to perfectionism, too. It's another part of it. Sometimes you're doing something that's complicated. There is no right answer. No one's ever proven there's a right answer. There's only answers that fit in a certain circumstance. If you're searching for the right answer, there won't be any. If you're searching for the right way to advertise your services, if you're the right way to describe something, there may not be a right way. There's only trying which ways might work. And you have to be willing to be open. You have to I have a little sign in my office that says, approach life like an artist. Creatively.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be creative. You have to be open to not just the experience of the world around you, but what you put out and allow yourself to try different things.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, what?
And the way that creativity flows is by creating for yourself and not creating for an audience.
Right, because there's the inner critic who believes they're always editing themselves. In fact, in the book Writing Down the Bones by, I believe it's Natalie Goldberg, she talks about the inner critic. And I Cameron, who writes The Artist's Way, also talks about the inner critic. If you're constantly editing yourself, mm-hmm. you really can't go forward.
You're not getting anything done. Exactly.
Well, I would say that, you know, and here's an aphorism I use with people. If I reveal my true self, somebody will like me. And that's often part of the fear with this. I don't like myself. I don't like some part of me. But guess what? That's your opinion. Maybe someone else has an entirely different opinion. And in fact, they do.
Mm. That's really interesting because I think people do often have the feeling that I won't be liked, people won't approve of me. And that's another thing. I always think, where is that seed planted? Like, how does that start that people won't approve of them or won't like them? Where does that come from?
Well, I guess early childhood and maybe gets reinforced again in school. Well, if you're popular if you do this, but you're bad if you do that. And people, kids tend to set things up. It may not be very logical, but in this situation, this is what we like, this is what we don't like.
Mm.
But then when you get to be older, you'll find that even things that are weaknesses, someone else can appreciate. Someone can be happy. Well, gee, you know... thank goodness this girl that I'm dating, is a scatterbrain, because otherwise she'd be too intimidating.
Mm.
Otherwise, you know, perfect is just too scary.
Yeah.
You know, we want, you know, and the person who has the problem just feels very frustrated by it and very unhappy by it. Oh, my goodness, you know, I don't, you know, my hair is a mess. I mean, how can I go to work, or what are people going to think? And they're thinking, Oh, thank goodness, finally a day that she came in less than perfect, and therefore I don't feel as bad about myself.
That's a great point, but it makes me think about the magazines we read or television, when really the images, which are two-dimensional images, are look perfect. The legs are long and beautiful.
And
the
they're
hair
airbrushed.
Is, oh, and they're airbrushed to boot. So we sometimes, I guess, compare ourselves to images that are not real, not really human. So you're saying, as a human, we all have our little spots of problems and little challenges. So we're less than perfect, but that makes us unique.
Well, in every human being, there is no such thing as absolute symmetry, even between different sides of the body, different, you know, there is no such thing as the perfect anything.
That's exactly right. Although as in neurology, we do compare side to side. We do look for symmetry, but it never has to be perfect. Although when it's a little off, that's sometimes when our radar is up wondering if anything is wrong. But you talk a little bit in one of your paralysis examples, you talk about should-isms. What are should-isms?
Whenever you start saying the word should, I should do this, I should do that. You know, I'll go out and, you know, go to the health club with you, but I should be home working on this project. Whatever I'm doing, I should be doing something different. I feel guilty no matter what I'm doing because I should be doing something else, or I should be doing more. There's 100 things I should be doing, and if I do one, I'm not doing the other 99. Mm. So that leads to paralysis. Some of that is you need to give up some of these shoulds. You need to give up some of the ideas. You don't need them. You don't really need to do everything. There's 100. One fellow in therapy once said to me, I said, what's your top priority? And he says, I got 10 of them. I said, that means you got none. And he was a computer programmer. So I said, well, how does a computer work? It works one priority, then another, then another. If there's two, what you get is a glitch and it doesn't work. And I said, well, that's you. You know, you have to have, even if all 10 are important, you have to do one at a time. I mean, I the way I teach priorities is I say, imagine that you're in a car that's about to careen off a cliff. And at the same time, you have a wound where you will bleed to death in an hour. And you've taken a poison that if you don't get the antidote in 20 minutes, you will die.
And what's hold your, that. Yes, I'm sorry. Go on.
And I said, and what's your priority? I said, first, you got to, if the car doesn't stay, if the car goes off the cliff, all bets are off. Then you got to get the antidote in 20 minutes. And you still got 40 minutes left to stop the bleeding before you're dead. But if you do it in the wrong order, you're finished.
Big trouble. Well, hold that thought. Okay. That's a great example. It gives you a lot of visual. We're going to take a break. And we'll come back in a few minutes, speaking to Dr. Michael Grove on the positive mind. And a little later, we'll be taking your calls. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute. Hi, you've come back to the positive mind. This is Dr. Sherry Siegel on 99.5. We're here today with Dr. Michael Grove and Lauren Sykes. And we're talking about paralysis of the mind and of the brain. We're on the edge of a mountain. Almost going to have a car accident, die from poisoning, and we're not sure what to do. So we want to break the paralysis. How would we do that, Michael?
Okay. Well, in a case like this, and actually some people live their lives where there's a series of emergencies with different timelines, you have to focus intently on the first thing. What do I need to do now? What's most important now? What will happen if I don't do it now? What's going to happen? And that can guide you through the set of the priorities, what you have to do first.
Mm-hmm. So you're taking it almost in a temporal
yes.
Sequence.
You put it in a temporal order.
Right, and that makes a lot of sense. You talked once about the coercion sensitivity. What is coercion sensitivity, and how does that paralyze someone psychologically?
Well, that's very common. And the coercion sensitivity is when you feel that if you listen to what someone else tells you to do, you lose yourself. You know, so if you were going to clean your room today, you decided on your own, I'm going to clean my room or I'm going to clean the living room. And your partner or your roommate says, before you've even said anything to them or before you've done it, said to them, clean your room right now. And you say, who are they to tell me what to do? I'm not going to listen to them.
So you get defiant.
You get defiant. You feel that if you go follow through on the action, you've lost your autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
You've already given them over power. But instead of the going along with the power, you are fighting the power.
Mm. I bet this happens a lot with teenagers and parents.
Oh, it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kid's going to put the coat on before he goes out. The mother says, or the father says, put the coat on. I don't need the coat.
Right. I think, I suppose teenagers are growing up and they're claiming their autonomy. It's so
they want
anyone
their autonomy more than anything else, no matter
yes.
what the consequences.
Yes.
And sometimes that happens in relationships also. Well, if someone tells me to do it and I do it, that means I was wrong and they're right and they're better than I am. Instead of have my own mind and my own independence. If you have your independence, it's very hard for someone to take it away from you.
Mm-hmm.
You can independently agree to follow the rules. In fact, the mantra that I use with people is, if I follow someone's rules, it doesn't mean I've lost control of myself. I mean, after all, if you play sports, you're playing by the rules.
That's
it
right.
It doesn't mean you're not in control of yourself. In fact, it takes greater control of yourself to play by the rules than to not play by the rules.
That's right. I guess we live in a democracy where there are rules, and when we don't follow those rules, we become outsiders or outcasts. So that does make a lot of sense. You talk about some people who just don't care about anything. People who feel they have no desire. What about, I can imagine how that would paralyze somebody. What about a person who feels that they have no desire, no oomph? They don't really care to do anything.
Well, the first thing I would do is ask them, did you used to care about doing stuff? Are there things that gave you pleasure before that doesn't give you pleasure now? And if that's the case, just maybe the problem is a symptom of depression or something else or something larger that's going on that this lack of interest is telling you, pay attention to.
Right. So severe depression, and even as a neurologist, I've seen patients who are in a catatonic state, and that means they are essentially paralyzed. They can't get out of bed. They can't really move. They look as if they have had a stroke because they don't move at all. And so catatonia is something that you can see in depression. There are other states in the neurological disorders. Cataplexy, for example, where someone has a strong emotion and suddenly collapses to the ground. It's part of the narcolepsy quadrant. So they're thinking about the paralysis one feels when they are depressed. What can help somebody who is in that severe state of depression?
Well, again, the question is to understand why they're in it. If, for example, a parent has died in the recent past, perhaps you're in mourning. Perhaps you need to cry. Perhaps that is your focus and your body is telling you, no, I can't go on to something else. I have some unfinished business. I have something that's important for me to do. There are people, it's a fine line, you know. There are people who the boyfriend leaves them and they don't want to do anything. Well, okay, you can give that a little time, I guess. But then beyond that, you have to move on. So it could be that you're holding on to something that's no longer there. If you go back to the stroke victim, or someone that has, say, partial paralysis, the one arm is paralyzed, but the rest of them is okay. They could say, well, I'm not who I used to be, therefore, I'm not interested in anything else. I'm not interested in developing something else.
Right. So, in other words, they can't leave their old identity to really morph into somebody new, a new person, old person connected with the new challenges.
The question is, when does the struggle end, they might ask me. Never. is often the answer. There's always a new challenge.
Mm-hmm. In Buddhism, there are the Four Noble Truths. Really, they're all about suffering. So that suffering is an integral part of our lives, the same way joy might be and anything might be. So, one of the other categories you talk about, which I think is very interesting, is unassertiveness. Someone who actually says yes when I should say no. What sort of paralysis would that give you?
Well, you said yes to something, but it doesn't mean you want to do it. It doesn't mean you're going to do it.
Mm.
It means you put the time and the energy into fighting doing it. And because it sets up a conflict. Well, all right, I agreed to do this, but I don't really want to do it. For example, someone goes to a job interview and is offered a job. Oh my God, I can't say no. I have no other job. Although, oh, this job's terrible. I really don't want to do it. It's nearly not right for me. I don't like it. It's all kinds of arguments I have against it. But I don't say no. I say yes.
Mm-hmm. Slog on, basically.
And then I think it over, and I think it over, and I think it over. Well, I got to accept the job or reject it. Well, I got to accept the job or reject it. Days go by, and then finally you say, no, I can't do it. In the meantime, where was I looking for another job? No, I'm thinking over this offer. I know it. People will sometimes be asked, will you do me a favor? Oh, sure, of course. I don't want to do the favor. Do I end up doing it? No, well, I forget. Well, I forgot. Well, I'll do it later. So sometimes procrastination is just a way of being afraid to turn the yes that you made into a no. Mm. And that can often be because you're afraid of the consequences. You're afraid someone will get angry at you. You're afraid of asserting yourself. You're afraid of standing up for yourself. You're afraid of feeling your strength and recognizing you have the right to say no. Sometimes people have something called assertiveness training, where they have to learn very specifically not only how to say no, but how to express what their needs are. This often happens in dating, particularly in the beginning, too, where, well, sure, oh, I really like this person, so I agreed to do X or I agreed to do Y, and I really wanted to say no. I didn't want to do it. But, I know, overall, it's better to, have this person than not. But I couldn't just say, well, look, sure, yes, I want to be with you, but no, I don't want to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, I want to do that thing. So
Learning to say no is
very important.
And it's a way of preventing becoming paralyzed.
Yes, that's right. Because when you're doing something you don't really want to do, sometimes you don't do it at all. Sometimes you drag it out. Sometimes you don't really do it fully. And that looks like paralysis.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, we'd like to hear from listeners to see if they've had any challenges with paralysis of the mind or of the body. And so if you'd like to call in, the number is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. Tell us if you have felt paralyzed, blocked, unable to move either in your mind or in your body. And we'll go back to talking about some of these very interesting psychological paralyses that Michael has listed. And he talks about confrontation or conflict paralysis. What is conflict paralysis, Michael?
Well, conflict paralysis is when you're afraid to take an action. And if you take the action, You're afraid it's going to create negative emotions in other people. They're going to be angry with you. They're going to demand something from you. You're going to have to do some more work.
And
whatever it is, you're afraid of that extra effort. So you don't do anything. You stay stuck.
Mm-hmm.
I can't allow myself to do something. It's almost like frustration freeze that I talked about earlier, where you say there's too many outside things to do, except that this is with other people.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I think we have a caller on the line. Welcome to WBAI. Who's on the line?
Hi, my name is Raphael. I'm from Queens, New York.
Hey, Raphael.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. I was listening to you guys talk about the paralysis of the mind, and I have to say that's a constant with me. Like, I'm always fighting what I have to do.
So you are suffering from paralysis of the mind every day, constantly fighting what's in front of you, what you need to do. Any particular things that you fight, or is it everything, Raphael?
Well, it's mostly everything. I mean, I can't say I don't want to be alive, because I definitely want to do that, but... You know, my problem is, like, focusing on what I have to do.
So focusing is a real challenge for you.
What do you have to do that you don't want to focus on?
Well, I constantly make plans. For example, I learned through WBAI that composting would help, you know, the rat problem in my community. And I constantly tell myself, oh, I got to go find out how it's done. What could I do to help it? And I just, days go by, I finish working every day early, and I just don't do anything, you know. It's like I tell myself to do it, and I
you
just
sort of
mean
have
you should do it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
You mean you should do it.
Yeah, I should do, yeah.
You have a kind of an inertia. So what can we offer Raphael to help him with his inertia, or what would you say?
Well, why should you do it? I know you told me how it will help the community. How will it help you personally?
Well, I guess it's an accomplishment for me. You know, if I can bring this to my community and have it work, and actually literally help out the planet, so to speak, it would be an incredible accomplishment. You know, I would.
So you would feel more accomplished.
Yeah.
Is there any way in which you feel accomplished now?
Through work, you know, I work Monday through Friday, and I pay my rent. You know, I feed myself and all that good stuff. You know, I keep myself alive. I guess that's an accomplishment in and of itself.
Yes, it is.
Now, who would appreciate your accomplishment if you did the composting?
I guess everybody that's complaining about the rats in my neighborhood.
They would know that you personally did your part?
Oh, I wouldn't want that. I mean, I would feel proud just seeing a change. You know, I wouldn't care who knew what I did. I mean, it would be good to be recognized for it, but it's not the most important part.
Well, maybe
it's definitely not that.
Maybe it's more important to you than you think. Maybe that would unlock the paralysis if you made a commitment to a specific person. Tomorrow I'm going to do the composting, and maybe you could do it with me, or I'll let you know how it goes. Then you could get the pleasure of the reward for having done it. I appreciate your spirit of community, and that's very important, but you're taking off a big chunk, change the rat problem. And maybe it needs to be cut down to a smaller size to be recognized for doing a part of the problem.
Mm, and it makes me think about being a beginner. Having not composted before, really you're a beginner. And sometimes it helps to get a hand up, someone who's maybe familiar with composting. And the people in the neighborhood who hate the rats, maybe there's someone among them who could help. Who knows about composting. But I agree. I really applaud your community spirit.
Yeah, asking for help sometimes is very hard for some people, and that leads to a lot of paralysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Raphael, for calling. That was a great call. And so we're gonna hear from another caller. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Oh, hello.
Hi, who are we talking to?
Hi, my name is Keith.
Keith, thanks for calling. And how have you experienced paralysis, Keith?
Well, I guess it's probably a common problem, but public speaking. I get frozen talking in front of a crowd.
Mm.
And, pretty frustrating because, you know, I have a lot of things that I want to say, and when I get up there, all I can think about is the crowd of people in front of me, and I could, you know, I basically get stuck, and I don't really know how to get around it.
Mm, I think that so many of us listening, including myself and people in the audience, can really relate to the freeze that people get. In fact, I was talking about this earlier, how I sometimes look for words and suddenly I will freeze. So I can really relate to that. Michael, do you have anything that we can help Keith with?
Oh, this is a very common problem, and I've helped many people with it. And the first question to ask you, Keith, is what do you imagine is in the minds of the other people when you get up there and you talk? Mm. What is your fear? What do you expect they will think or say or do? And very often, I don't know about you, but very often people will say, well, I'm afraid they'll judge me, and they'll judge me harshly, and they'll judge me in some way that I'm already judging myself.
Mm.
And there are people who will say, well, they will see that I'm scared, as mm-hmm. though that's a problem. They might find that okay. Sometimes they'll say, well, they will think that I don't know anything. What's really important to realize is you can express yourself. And if you enjoy expressing yourself, that joy will come across.
Mm.
And that will make up for a lot of problems, real or imagined.
Mm.
And that sometimes role-playing it is very important also.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And some of those are the things that have really helped me as well. Talking to friends, doing it out loud with people who I know support me. Sometimes I even think about or take pictures of people who support me, put them in my pocket, because then I feel like I'm not alone. Someone has told me also to make connection, like an eye connection, with someone in the audience who I feel might be a friendly face, or even ahead of time connect with a person or two who I can look for in the audience. It's a painful. I can think back to the times I began to speak, and it was really a challenge for me. So I can feel your pain, Keith. I'm glad you called.
Thank you
for calling. And so we're going to take another call right now. And hi, you're on the air. It's The Positive Mind. Who are we talking to?
Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. What a great show. Hey, the reason why I called is that, you know, it's an intriguing topic. I went away for the 4th of July weekend with some man that I've been involved with on and off for 5 years. And, you know, it's about shock and feeling paralyzed. He had won, like, a Lifetime Achievement Award that he waited 31 years to get. And when he won the award, I kind of, like, helped him do the bio, which helped him get there. There was no mention of me in his acceptance speech, and I could feel my whole body go into shock and freeze. I said to myself, oh, my God, I couldn't move.
So, in other words, it was your lack of being recognized caused you to have a sense of being frozen.
Totally. There was no mention of me at all. He mentioned the two promoters that gave him the award and the Lifetime Achievement Award, the guy who died, who was named after. And I couldn't believe it. I kept on waiting to see, you know, just him to recognize me. You know, you didn't have to say anything big. But there was no mention of me at all, and I said to myself,
oh, what a disappointment.
What could have happened here? It was a shock, and
I never
want to see him again.
I wonder what you were feeling, as you just said. You didn't want to see him again. I think that you were
very felt
angry.
humiliated.
Well, humiliation often can lead to paralysis because it creates a tremendous self-criticism.
Yes.
A self-critical situation where whatever I do is no good. I shouldn't really be there. You know, how humiliating it is that I would have someone that would think so low of me that I would help for so long and then they would ignore me. Somehow you make it your fault when it's really not. And that could be part of the paralysis.
No. I don't feel that I made it my fault. I felt that, you know, the guy's like, you know, he's a creep. He's a jerk. I didn't blame myself.
That's
no.
Good. That's very helpful.
But the thing is that, am I wrong? Is it possible? He's been apologizing and leaving messages that he actually forgot. My friends and family feel no. Usually when people win greater awards, they thank the people who mean the most to them. So I felt that, obviously, how much could I mean if I wasn't even on his mind in this wonderful moment?
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong?
Well, I won't say you're right or you're wrong. I will say that something you need to work out with him. But I would say that the feeling of paralysis comes about, like you said, with a shock sometimes when we have emotions that are so strong, we don't know how to deal with them at that
exactly.
moment.
Exactly. I felt like I couldn't walk.
Mm.
I was frozen.
You know, when these strong emotions come up, they resonate and they stick around. The ones that are sticky like that, they're ones, it's an opportunity to really work with them and find out what's happening, because it'll be a process before this becomes resolved. There is, just like Michael is saying, there's no right or wrong, but you're entitled to your feelings.
Well, so, I don't know. That's what I like. I like a definitive answer. Was this horrible? How horrible on a scale of 1 to 10 was what this man did to me? This was a lifetime achievement award. He waited 31 years. These opportunities don't present too often. How bad is it that he left me out?
Thank you, Suzanne. I thank you for calling. We are coming to our last moments in the show, and I want to thank you again for calling and for everybody who called, and certainly to Dr. Grove for coming and sharing such interesting information with us. Thank you for coming, Dr. Grove.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here. It was a lot of fun.
I'm so glad. And Lauren Sykes, for your research, we always appreciate you. This is Dr. Sherry Siegel sitting in for Armand DeMille on the Positive Mind. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.
that somebody dragged me with me.